Hub
and Spoke
Audio Collective.
There are two popular origin stories for America. One takes place in 1607 in the South and involves a failing colony being turned around by the brave actions of a young Powhatan princess, Matawaka, nicknamed Pocahontas. The other takes place in 1620 in the North and involves a failing colony being turned around by the patient tutelage of Tisquantum, nicknamed Squanto, a Pawtuxet man who unlocked the secrets of a new land for its new settlers. Both origin stories are, of course, not origin stories at all. This wasn't like Neil Armstrong stepping onto the moon for the first time. Neither the Jamestown settlers nor the Plymouth settlers were stepping onto virgin ground untouched by human feet. No, it's right there in the text of both stories. The story had already begun long ago. But when? It's just like with Spider-Man, right? There needs to be a moment when something became something else. What is the radioactive spider bite that started America? Which raises one obvious problem. There can't be two origin stories for America. For there to be clarity, there needs to be just one story. Just one moment. Now, since both the American origin stories essentially follow the same arc as we just saw, have the same players, you'd think the deciding factor would probably be which one came earlier. But something about the earlier origin story is just... off? We all know how this ends. The first origin story did get a Disney movie, and the second origin story got everything else. The prestige, the recognition, the elementary school pageants with kids dressed in buckled hats and buckled shoes. But what if I told you these two separate origin stories were almost one single origin story? A continued thread connected by one man. And that only a few small decisions kept this man from sealing the deal and leading both settlements, both Jamestown and Plymouth. What then? Possibly nothing. There's a chance that nothing I say will change your mind about the man or the two origin stories of America. But I think we should have the conversation anyway. The conversation about how John Smith made New England and how New England destroyed John Smith. This is Iconography, and I'm Charles Gustine, your guide on this tour of icons, real and imagined. I am so ready to take this tour of the ideas that have defined New England all the way back to the beginning. I'm ready, but I'm not sure I'm able. A beginning is a very hard thing to find, as it turns out. In an attempt to find a first icon of New England, the first giant footsteps in which we can still walk today, the first shout that still echoes, however faintly, I'm skipping millennia of geology, apologies to the Laurentide ice sheet that shaped the Appalachians and the New England coast, and I'm also skipping over millennia of human settlement as we zoom ahead to the 17th century. And to be honest, I don't feel great about it. My promise is that as we meet some of the icons whose ancestors lived in New England long before the 1600s in upcoming episodes, I will strive to tell their stories. Since this season is about New England, let's fast forward to the moment this region was rechristened with that name. All right, press play, and we're in New Hampshire. Prologue. The Admiral of New England. Portsmouth, New Hampshire is very old, as American cities go. Old is relative. The Portsmouth it's named after in England is at least twice as old. But still, with a founding date of 1623, sort of, it's complicated, Portsmouth dates back to pretty much New England Year Zero. Scratch that. What we think of as New England Year Zero. Because when the Pilgrims land at Provincetown and then Plymouth in 1620, they have detailed maps that let them know pretty much exactly where they are. As a matter of fact, one of the crew members of the Mayflower has already been here to Cape Cod. They already have those names, too. Cape Cod, New England, Plymouth even. The Pilgrims didn't invent those names. When the settlers finally meet a native a few months after they land, he walks right into their camp and greets them in English. And a few days later, he brings along another dude who speaks English even better. Clearly, an important part of this story has gone missing. Let's find it. Over the next two episodes, we're going to look at two icons, people whose names you already know really well, who were in New England years before the Pilgrims showed up. One of them born in the Old World who chose to spend a few years in the New One, the other born in the New World who was forced to spend a few years in the Old One. We can't truly be prepared to think about Plymouth Rock in 1620 until we think about these two icons in 1614. To begin that journey back to 1614, my wife Carolyn and I stop a few miles outside of Portsmouth at Rye Harbor State Park, We walk out onto a grassy peninsula, and at the center of the peninsula is a white granite obelisk that stands 16 feet, 14 inches high. The height is intentional.
I think you're allowed.
This is the 1614 monument, inscribed with that year on the front below a gold-plated map of New England, a replica of the first map, the one that gave it that name. In the top right corner of the map is an engraving of the Admiral of New England, a confident-looking man, generous of both beard and mustache.
Different from the movie.
The vista beyond the obelisk is of the far-off Isles of Shoals, which, well, I'll let Carolyn read the plaque for you.
Offshore, these nine rocky islands served Europeans as a fishing station before the first mainland settlements were made in 1623. Captain John Smith named the group Smith's Isles in 1614.
Yes, that John Smith. Colors of the Wind, John Smith.
Look and think like you, but if you walk the footsteps of a stranger,
part one,
you'll learn things,
you never knew. I want to highlight this, underline it, circle it, and put it in bold. The man who literally put New England on the map, as we'll soon see, who paved the way for the only colonial settlers more famous than the Jamestown settlers, was the most famous of the Jamestown settlers, Captain John Smith. This wasn't some rando. This was like the first guy you hear about in your American history class. A quick review of that chapter of the textbook, since Disney's Pocahontas has muddied the waters a bit. John Smith was an English captain and adventurer, born in 1580 in Lincolnshire. After a decade of military escapades across Europe, Smith took his talents to the New World in 1607 as one of the founding members of the first successful settlement in America, Jamestown. Successful is relative. It was successful in that it didn't disappear into the mist like Roanoke had, but it was less successful in that it never turned a profit for the Virginia Company, and there are accounts that starvation was such a problem that people resorted to cannibalism, so... yeah, not so successful in some ways, too. Depending on which of his fellow settlers you asked, John Smith was either the lone bright light in the darkness, or he was some young braggart with delusions of grandeur, ordering around gentlemen well above his station, barking, "He that shall not work shall not eat." Oh, and somewhere in there he may or may not have been spared from execution by a princess. That too. After this, after Jamestown, is where we tend to lose interest in John Smith as an icon. But we're going to stay with him, follow him back to England, because in his day, John Smith still has a long way to go. He's going to become a famous writer, mapmaker, and explorer. By 1620, when a group of separatists living in Leiden decide it's time for a new start in the New World, they know they have to at least, like, set up an obligatory meeting with the foremost authority on the New World, Captain John Smith. We don't know much about this almost impossible to fathom interview between the settlers we now know as the Pilgrims and John Smith, their candidate for their security detail, but we do know it left quite a sour taste in John Smith's mouth. He later scoffed, "About 100 of your Brownists of England, Amsterdam, and Leiden, whose humorous ignorances caused them for more than a year to endure a wonderful deal of misery with an infinite patience, saying my books and maps were much better cheap to teach them than myself. They would not have any knowledge by any but themselves, pretending only religion their governor and frugality their council, when indeed it was because they would have no superiors." The Pilgrims went with a more malleable military man. Miles Standish may have never been to the New World before, but he wouldn't treat his charges like his backup singers. This is one of history's great missed connections. I can imagine the posting on ye old Reddit now. "Embarking settlers, did you make it to the New World okay? I was on a ferry across the Thames, deep in reminiscences about my glory days in Jamestown, when I heard about your trip. You were a band of refugees looking for a new start in the New World. I'm the guy whose face is on your map of the New World. It seemed like fate. I may have set me asking price a bit high. I've heard you've brought along some soldier bloke, you know, from Leiden to teach you about muskets and survival, Stanley Miles or some such. Look, if he don't work out, you know, send a note to London. I've got nothing on at the moment, and I'm willing to relocate if it means reconnecting. Do not contact me with unsolicited services or offers." When I discovered how close John Smith came to leading the Pilgrims, I flipped. This is why I study history, for magical moments like this, too good to be true nuggets of truth. I started Googling furiously, figuring John Smith's surprise New England icon must be commemorated somewhere, somewhere I could take all of you. The results were surprisingly sparse. As much as this is a story of a physical icon, this is the story of an icon in absentia. A hole where an icon seems like it should be. But there was one lead to follow, which is how we ended up on a secluded grassy peninsula in New Hampshire, standing in the shadow of an obelisk with a golden map and the year 1614 on it.
You have to read it in your pirate voice.
What?
By the iron threshold.
Do I have a pirate voice?
When John Smith passed this way in 1614, past the islands that would one day bear his name, but bear it no longer, and the peninsula that now commemorates his journey from Maine to Cape Cod, the most famous thing he would ever do, or really would have done to him, the rescue at Jamestown, had already happened 7 years hence, in 1607. What we don't know is if he was already famous for it then, in 1614. Maybe everyone had been gossiping about it for 7 years, how the young captain had been spared from execution by an Indian princess, and we just don't have records of that gossip. The records start 2 years later in 1616 with a letter that Smith wrote to Queen Anne, telling her about the noble sacrifice of this visiting ambassador from America, how Pocahontas had saved him from a killing blow. He wouldn't publish that story publicly until 1624, 17 years after it had happened, a time gap which will become very important later. But just because people didn't know the story of John Smith and Pocahontas didn't mean they didn't know John Smith. Because Smith, rescue or no, was a prominent media figure of his day, a best-selling author steadily beating the drum for the colonization of the New World. He was young and roguish and interesting, a veteran of multiple European wars who claimed to have slain three Turks in a duel and had escaped from slavery in Crimea. And sure, he may have been a little full of himself, but maybe he'd earned the right. He had arrived at Jamestown in chains, accused of planning a mutiny. And he had left the colony not just a president, but as the only president who had anything of substance to show for his work. He was Mr. New World, and he wanted to get back and see more of it. And even though Smith was very clear that Virginia would not be kind to get-rich-quick schemes, when it came to the New World, investors with gold coins dancing in their eyes wanted to help him get there. They wanted to be in the John Smith business. And John Smith was not going to turn away business. That's how Smith ended up crossing the Atlantic again in 1614, with two ships and crews under his command. The objectives, as the investors saw them, were twofold. Gold, and something that was nearly as valuable, whales. Our ambitious but broke captain, military kind, not the ship kind for the record, must have been a smooth talker because John Smith was a lot of things, but he was no whaler. So John and his ships reach these overflowing fishing grounds off the coast of what we now know as Maine, and the whaling experts he brings along get to whaling, and they are absolute rubbish at it. Many whales are seen, not a one is killed. Now John Smith is surprisingly unfazed by this. He shrugs this seemingly critical failure off and tells his crew, go catch some little fish that we might be able to sell over in Spain. He's going to go off over here with a small group, westward. All the way down the coast to Cape Cod. The men he brings along dream of gold. The captain, knowing better, dreams of something else. He's gonna rewrite the map of the New World and rebrand this wilderness with a fresh, more appealing identity. For the record, this area they explore is not a blank space on the map in 1614. It is known as Northern Virginia, actually. It's just not known very well. Still, this waterway was more heavily trafficked than you might expect, considering that the Pilgrims wouldn't show up for another 6 years. The bay that would soon become the Pilgrims' home had been mapped by a French explorer in 1605, and the cape that they would navigate around to get there had been christened Cape Cod as far back as 1602, by a man who would go on to settle Jamestown with John Smith, actually. And that name, Cape Cod, had proven effective marketing for at least one group of people, fishermen. Much better fishermen than John Smith and his crew. There had been one attempt at a permanent settlement in Maine in 1607 that had petered out, but for the most part, all this transatlantic traffic was coming from lots and lots of fishermen hauling cod and other goodies back to Europe. These men were not very much concerned with preserving knowledge for posterity. Heck, where the best bays and inlets are, those are trade secrets. That's not how our captain thinks. and that's what sets him apart in 1614. All he's fishing for is information. Throughout the summer of 1614, he makes what conversation with the natives he can, he trades, tries to find a way to turn a profit, but mostly, he takes copious notes. He seems to be scouting the best possible place for a settlement, and he thinks he finds one, too.
An excellent good harbor, good land, and no want of anything but industrious people.
You'll never guess where this paradise was. Yes, you will. It's almost as if John Smith had planned this from the outset. It's almost as if he never cared about whaling at all. What John Smith did actually care about, as it turns out, was map making. Apparently, he was excellent at it. The map he brought back to England of this coastline, by far the most comprehensive of its day, is apparently so accurate you could still pretty easily follow it now, even with the names having been changed. And follow it people did. Smith spent the rest of his life writing about this area, talking about it, encouraging its settlement, and it worked, obviously. Smith wanted so desperately to get back himself, he didn't want to be writing about it from afar. He organized one expedition that was scuttled by troubled seas, and, as we've heard, he was vetted as the military leader for another expedition of industrious people who inadvertently ended up settling his very good harbor in 1620. But alas, to his eternal regret, he was passed over, and he never did make it back to settle this new England. Instead, he had to settle for being the region's hype man from afar. John Smith never made it back after 1614, but his map did. The map became famous, essential, iconic. The map even passed through the hands of Prince Charles, with its map maker giving the heir to the crown free rein to fill in his map with names. Plenty of names that didn't stick, but also some names we still use, like Plymouth, Cape Anne, named for the prince's mother, and the Charles River, named for the prince. Charles liked John's coinage for the region, New England, and he kept it, finally setting this northern wilderness apart from Virginia once and for all. And he also let John maintain his eponymous isles. They're not called Smith's Isles anymore, but the old name still hangs around the area like a ghost.
And the ghost of John Smith.
Yes, that's from Pocahontas 2. Yes, I did watch Pocahontas 2 for this. For anyone hoping to commune with the spirit of John Smith in New England, this stretch of coastal New Hampshire around the Isles of Shoals is pretty much your only hope. And that's only really been possible for about 4 years. So, there has been a John Smith memorial on Star Island out there on the Isles of Shoals since 1864, the 250th anniversary of the 1614 expedition. It was originally a beautiful marble pillar on an inscribed granite base crowned with three carved heads, celebrating three John Smith beheadings in Transylvania. You'd think that that would be just morbid enough to draw a crowd, but the monument was allowed to fall into ruin, chunks eaten away by wind, storms, and time. By 1914, it was just a weathered granite base. And then that base got a new bronze plaque for the 300th anniversary, and then it was promptly allowed to fall back into ruin again. Google this monument, and the lion's share of results that you're going to find come from a few years ago, ruin seekers warning of poison ivy and seagulls on the way to this rock. I love you guys, and I love taking you to unique places, but I wasn't going to take a ferry to a small coastal island on the New Hampshire-Maine border to see a rusty plaque on a broken slab covered in pigeon droppings. And then, with a little more Googling, I did get some good news. People love their milestone years, and for the 400th anniversary in 2014, the Isles of Shoals monument had been rededicated. And even better, that same year, the state of New Hampshire finally caught on to the island monument's self-destructive pattern of falling into ruin, and they decided to dedicate a more accessible monument on the mainland within view of the Isles of Shoals, formerly Smith's Isles. On this monument, the obelisk that we visited earlier, John Smith's map is enshrined in gold and blown up to twice its original size. At the 2014 dedication of the Rye Harbor State Park obelisk, a four-minute speech was given by a man cosplaying as John Smith. Bearded, but not anywhere near bearded enough if the picture on the map is accurate.
And I have been traveling along this coastline in my shallop boat with a few of my men.
In his 4 minutes at the podium as John Smith, actor Paul Strand emphasized Smith's salesmanship.
Perhaps you should consider settling on those islands.
His position as de facto hype man for the new world.
Why, you could make your fortune here. Here every man may be master and owner of his own
labor. As well as his flair for self-promotion.
Some say I do not stint on praise for myself. George Percy, who succeeded me as president of Jamestown, wrote that I was an ambitious, unworthy, and vainglorious fellow. Ah! I but speak the truth of my own accomplishments.
If Smith was as vainglorious as George Percy claimed, then he probably would not be satisfied with the scene at Rye Harbor State Park on a typical sunny Saturday morning in May. The obelisk isn't the only granite on the peninsula. There's also this sort of pier jutting off to the south, made of giant slabs of granite that protrude out of the water, sizable cracks in between them, so you have to kind of hop from one to the next to progress to the pier's end. And as you might guess based on how fun that sounds, pretty much everyone there on a Saturday is focused on the giant granite playground, and pretty much no one is focused on the granite obelisk with 1614 on it. That's a fairly accurate representation of how much New Englanders care about 1614 relative to other more famous dates in New England history. Which begs the question, why all the rededications of monuments in the first place? Why couldn't any of these New England monuments to the very famous namer of New England stay dedicated? Well, as it turns out, John Smith, a marketer par excellence in his own day, has a bit of a PR problem.
But lucky for you, you're already in line to meet our next friend, the man who won Pocahontas' heart. It's Disney favorite, John Smith.
Part 2. The Elephant in the Room.
Hello. Who wants an autograph from Jamestown's most famous settler?
So, Pocahontas.
Hey, did you know that Pocahontas taught me about nature? Did you know that leaves are like a tree's hair?
All right, looks like currently no wait to chat with John Smith.
There's an amusing Cut for Time SNL sketch from a few years back starring Blake Shelton that has over 2.5 million views on YouTube. There's a long line in Fantasyland to meet Beauty and the Beast's Gaston, who is, it should be said, not a quality role model by any stretch of the imagination. But when Gaston has to leave for his lunch break, the crowd is immediately deflated as Taron Killam's cast member announces his replacement.
It's Disney favorite, John Smith.
Out comes Blake in a blue vest and blonde wig, and the line evaporates like it was never there. What mostly goes unsaid in this sketch is that it's not just that John Smith is an obscure character. There's something sketchy about John Smith, something that goes even deeper than his voice actor.
Voiced by actor Mel Gibson.
Come on, man, that's not gonna help.
There's a sort of edge to this ambivalence. It's not like the ambivalence to the love interests from Snow White or Cinderella. It's not a shrug. The ambivalence towards John Smith is kind of aggressive. Intentional. An eye roll.
Currently, no line to meet the adventurer who was captured by Indians, got shot, and had to return to England for medical attention. John Smith.
There have always been people who rolled their eyes at John Smith, going back to the 1600s. One contemporary of Smith's, David Lloyd, parodied Smith's epitaph. I repeat, his epitaph. The actual epitaph praised Smith as a man who had performed deeds which to the world impossible would seem, but that the truth is held in more esteem. Lloyd's parody, Captain Jones, was memorialized as a man who told his glorious deeds to many, but never was believed of any. Posterity, let this suffice, he swore all's true, yet here he lies. That clever kiss-off is simultaneously too hot to touch, and ice cold. Respect. That wasn't the consensus take on John Smith, though. Not for a long time. So, we've seen how John Smith made New England. Now it's time to see how New England returned the favor 230 years after his death by turning him into a pariah. John Smith died in London in 1631, not long after a group of Puritans, with Smith's descriptions of New England dancing in their heads, settled Boston. In his 50 years, Smith had spent well under three in America. He had spent over 20 years writing about that experience. John Smith wrote a lot, like a lot, a lot. Starting with his true relation, put a pin in that name, in 1608, he wrote about the severe infighting in the Jamestown colony. He wrote about the practices of the natives he encountered, about the laziness of the Jamestown gentlemen who just expected to, like, pull gold from the ground. Eventually, he broadened his scope. He wrote about his misadventures when he first left Lincolnshire as a young lad looking for adventure, about his young soldiering in the War for Dutch Independence, his exploits in Hungary that earned him the title of captain, his capture over there and enslavement, and about his daring escape from captivity in Crimea. As we've seen, he wrote tirelessly about New England, encouraging its settlement up until his dying day. But let's be honest with each other. We're all here because in 1624 he wrote one very particular thing. Having feasted him after their best barbarous manner they could. Yes, he did write in the third person. A long consultation was held, but the conclusion was, two great stones were brought before Powhatan. Then as many as could be laid hands on him, dragged him to them, and thereon laid his head, and being ready with their clubs to beat out his brains. Pocahontas, the king's dearest daughter, when no entreaty could prevail, got his head in her arms, and laid her own upon his to save him from death. From that one very long sentence, actually that wasn't the whole sentence by a long shot, America's original founding myth grew. John Smith, the brave knight-errant, the gentlemanly cavalier, and his savior, the gentle princess Pocahontas, soon to be the civilized Lady Rebecca. For decades, it sat there, something that had happened at the outset of Virginia, which was part of the British Empire, which had its own well-established origin myths. And then America gained independence, and this moment John Smith described suddenly became very important. Because for the first Americans, like Thomas Jefferson and Chief Justice John Marshall, both avowed John Smith fans, Smith became the first American. He may have only spent a few years there, but it was abundantly clear from his writings that he left his heart there when he sailed back to England. John saw an astounding amount of the world for his day, and of all the places he saw, he chose America as the hill he would proverbially, if not actually, die on. And even better, America had chosen him. I mean, that's the subtext of this story, right? This is why that one passage spurred an entire intellectual universe. Paintings and plays, arguments and counterarguments, films from Disney and director Terrence Malick. Pocahontas saving John Smith wasn't just John Smith's salvation. It became the creation of the idea of America. The way interpreters of the myth saw it, in that moment, a qualified ambassador for the New World, basically the New World itself, had interceded on behalf of a new type of person, an American, had pulled him into an embrace and welcomed him. Never mind that John Smith was injured within 2 years of this moment, sent home to England, dejected, cursed to spend the rest of his days trying to find a way back to the New World, only succeeding for that one blissful New England summer in 1614. And never mind that Pocahontas, actually named Matawaka, married a different John Rolfe, and that she died, like Captain Smith, in England, so far from where she wanted to be. Never mind all that. This was it. Kismet. From this moment, America was born, and John Smith and Pocahontas were its mommy and daddy, John Rolfe be damned. Which meant love.
Captain Smith and Pocahontas had a very mad affair. When her daddy tried to kill him, she said, "Daddy, oh, don't you dare give me fever."
Sometime around the early 19th century, 200 years after they had both died, John Smith and Pocahontas took their first tentative steps towards courtship. See, something strange happened. The very people who proudly burnished their descent from John Rolfe, the other guy, and Pocahontas didn't see anything strange about their very close readings of John Smith's texts for hints of any trace of romance between a preteen girl and a 27-year-old man who was not their ancestor. John Smith wrote a lot, but he certainly never wrote that romance. His fans wrote it for him. Fan fiction, long before Sherlock and Star Trek. Americans, and especially Virginians, started shipping Pocahontas and John Smith hard. And as we can hear from Peggy Lee's Fever, they've clearly never stopped. Through Disney's Pocahontas in 1995.
But I can't leave you.
You never will. No matter what happens, I'll always be with you. Forever.
Through Terrence Malick's The New World in 2005.
My true light.
Can the fly?
My America.
Where are you, my love?
They are the star-crossed lovers who gave us America. This was a clear corruption of history, driven by a blatant regional agenda with very icky implications. Two could play that game. Part 3. Don't believe the hype. 1870. Forefathers Day in Plymouth. The 250th anniversary of the Pilgrim's Landing. A Union war hero is asked to say a few words.
Plymouth and Jamestown, the Pilgrims and the Cavaliers, freedom and slavery. They met on the field at Gettysburg, and freedom conquered.
Remember at the beginning when I said that there were two origin stories, and only one could win? This is the part where the winning side plays a little dirty to ensure victory. To explain what happens next in the furnace of the Civil War when New England and Virginia started officially playing for separate teams, I'm going to turn to a sports metaphor. John Smith is like Babe Ruth. I know it's a stretch, just stick with me for a moment. In his career, Babe Ruth played for rival teams, first the Boston Red Sox, then the New York Yankees. His influence on the latter team was certainly greater, but his contributions to the former are nothing to sneeze at. Both the Bambino's presence and his absence defined the Red Sox for decades. Theoretically, in spite of all their differences then, both franchises should feel okay with co-ownership of this legendary icon's legacy. They should be able to, like, share custody of him. But that's not how this works. You only get to wear one cap when you're enshrined in Cooperstown. Babe Ruth is a Yankee. It's the province of stat heads to remind you that Ruth was so astounding in a Red Sox jersey as a two-way player that 95% of Red Sox players should feel ashamed to even attempt wearing the same socks. But no matter how much you're reminded, Babe Ruth is a Yankee. Perhaps this helps explain why New Englanders were so eager to tear down the explorer who had christened their region. Like Babe Ruth, John Smith had his cap picked for him, probably against his own wishes, considering how much he adored the northern region and groused about the southern one. Whether he likes it or not, he is a Virginian forever and ever. In truth, he was no more a southerner than I am a Londoner for having lived there for almost 2 years, but thanks to the power of the Pocahontas legend, southerners thought of him as a southerner. Northerners also thought of him as a southerner. No matter how much I talk up his New England cred, I'm not going to change his legacy. Although, if there's one thing I've learned in researching the shifting legacy of John Smith, it's that if I really put my back into it and make it my mission, maybe I could. The Thorough Dismantling of the Pocahontas Story in 1867 by prominent 19th century historian and dyed-in-the-wool Bostonian Henry Adams proves that a legacy can be a surprisingly easy thing to change. Henry Adams built his long literary career on top of a much ballyhooed revisionist reading of Smith's writings that cast the first Virginian and first New Englander as an extremely unreliable narrator. David Lloyd may have taken a swipe at John's trustworthiness all the way back in the 1600s, but it was Adams who firmly established Smith's enduring reputation as, in his words, as powerful a liar as he was a seaman. Smith's books, he claimed, were utter fantasy. In the absence of criticism, Adams sneered, due perhaps to the political excitement of the times, his book survived to become the standard authority on Virginia history. The readiness with which it was received is scarcely so remarkable as the credibility which has left it unquestioned to the present day. Adams was reviewing the unearthed manuscript of Edward Maria Wingfield's Discourse of Virginia. Wingfield had been a rival of John Smith's at Jamestown, had actually been the reason that Smith arrived at Jamestown in chains and was nearly hanged. His writings had been found and then edited and published by an influential amateur historian named Charles Dean in 1860. Now, Dean was the George Clooney behind an audacious Ocean's 11 heist that would see New England steal the up until that point sterling legacy of John Smith right out from under their Virginian rivals. Dean formed a team. A Unitarian minister named John Gorham Palfrey was his Brad Pitt, their young recruit with the famous last name. Yes, that Adams, with both a grandfather and great-grandfather as presidents, was their Matt Damon. Together, these three led a cabal of New England historians, no seriously, a cabal, with a very clear aim. They were going to make an argument which aims at nothing less than the erasure of one of the most attractive portions of American history. I'm not making this up. These three may have legitimately believed that Smith had lied, but they were really bad at hiding their glee when they found what they thought of as proof. These historians had an agenda that went beyond historical rigor. This was warfare through historical interpretation, as coordinated an attack as anything that Grant or Sherman planned. Defiling the veracity of John Smith's larger-than-life accounts of his own life would thoroughly cripple the iconography upon which the Southern identity was draped, which would also open the door for the burgeoning Plymouth Rock, Thanksgiving, Miles Standish myth to have pride of place in the American origin story pecking order. So, a twofer. In 1862, Adams excitedly wrote to his mentor in the world of John Smith trutherism, Charles Dean, that their coordinated efforts would be a rear attack on the Virginia aristocracy who will be utterly graveled if we succeed. And graveled they were. It was really easy to do, too. John Smith did not equip his legacy with a very sound security system. His writings were pockmarked with inconsistencies, continuity errors, if you will. And he didn't publish an account of his rescue at the hands of Pocahontas until years after she had come to London as a visiting dignitary. Until she was a celebrity, basically. By the time that John Smith did publish it, Pocahontas and her husband were dead, so they couldn't call Smith out for any fallacies. It was so, so easy to accuse Smith of just, you know, name-dropping. Oh yeah, I knew Pocahontas. She saved me one time. This was a coordinated attack. Encouraged by Dean, Palfrey had jabbed at Smith's authorship in 1858, then Dean, he hit low in 1860 by publishing the manuscripts of Wingfield, a man who had despised Smith, and then treating this as impartial contemporary observation rather than the character assassination that it was. And then in 1867, Henry Adams, coaxed on by his mentors Dean and Palfrey, landed the knockout blow, an absolutely devastating swipe at John Smith's authenticity. Adams scrupulously compared Smith's own accounts of the rescue, highlighting every detail that didn't match up. What he didn't have was evidence that the rescue didn't happen, but if Smith had been telling the truth, he wouldn't have changed his story. Come on. So obviously John Smith was a liar, and Adams threw down the gauntlet, declaring all right-minded historians must pick a side. And pick sides they did. Historians from the South tried feebly to bat down a wave of historical claims from the North that were way more outlandish than anything that John Smith could have ever dreamed up. And in doing so, these Southern historians came up with fresh absurdities of their own. Smith quickly gained a reputation as, in one historian's words, a Gascon and a beggar, always in the attitude of one craving recognition or remuneration for alleged services. Once Smith was branded a liar, everything he had ever said was fair game for reassessment. A Hungarian scholar figured if Smith had lied about Virginia, he might have lied about his earlier exploits in Eastern Europe, and the findings that that Hungarian scholar published decapitated Smith as definitively as Smith had decapitated those three Turks in battle, if you could even believe that anymore. In 1891, J. Franklin Jameson, accepting what was now the status quo, summed up Smith's incredibly quick fall from grace thusly: what was historical was not his, and what was his was not historical. I hope, after the history heist that we all just witnessed, a few little red flags popped up in your mind hearing that. Historical. What does that even mean? Either something happened, or it didn't happen. Historical is just what is currently accepted as the best possible version of the truth. A consensus. As we've seen, that consensus is far from fixed. History is collective memory, and memory is not fact. It's not a video recording of what happened. It's much more slippery and slithery than that. It transforms into something that becomes true, even if it never was. It's hard enough for one person to keep their memories straight. Actually, it's impossible. We trick ourselves into remembering things that never happened. I highly recommend the incredible recent episode of Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History on Brian Williams and the Science of Memory. So, you can imagine how foolhardy a task it is for all humans to agree upon a collective memory. I think I like John Smith because he accidentally proved the fallacy, or at least the fallibility, of historical memory, both through his own writings and then through all the writings that he's inspired. I guess I should clarify, I like John Smith the idea. I have no idea whether I like John Smith the man because he keeps eluding me. There's this moment in filmmaker Terrence Malick's nearly 3-hour meditation on all this Mishigas, the new world, where Pocahontas can't peg down where John Smith's head is at. Smith, trying to convince her that she's built him up too much, says,
"Don't trust me. You don't know who I am."
And she thinks in her own narration,
"Who are you? Who am I, love?"
Amen, sister. Who are you, John Smith? Every time I think I've got you pegged down, you slip away. Every article I read and thought I have sees you go from fraud to folk hero and back again. There's an angel and devil on each shoulder, and I can't tell which is even which anymore. Is the one defending John Smith the angel or the devil? I've lost track. Here's what I can make out. The current consensus among historians seems to be that actually, John Smith was as honest a memoirist and historian as his time period would allow. It took decades, and the work of many historians, as well as, if you can believe it, a team of Boy Scouts testing a messaging system that Smith had described, to redeem his reputation. Together, they mostly undid what Adams, Dean, and Palfrey, and especially that Hungarian scholar who turned out to be a bit of a fraud, had done. History had largely swung back to John Smith's side by the 100th anniversary of Adams' devastating review. There is still a lot of doubt about the veracity of the Pocahontas rescue story, with many insisting Smith absolutely got it wrong. But there are now alternative theories for why Smith insisted it had happened, in spite of his overwhelming tendency towards honesty. Maybe he misunderstood a ritual that was never meant to be an execution. Or maybe he misremembered events years after the fact once Pocahontas came back into his life. He inserted her where she hadn't been. Or maybe, just maybe, he told the truth. The arguments against that insist, no, the preteen daughter of a chief would never have been in the places that John Smith places her. No chance. No way. That's just not how the culture worked. But we don't know that she wasn't. What if she was, just that day? Or maybe John Smith did lie. The arguments against that insist that we now know. Where John Smith can be proved, he proves to be honest. Why would he lie about this, begrudgingly admit that a brave adventurer like him had found himself helpless, saved only by the grace of a little girl? It just wouldn't be in character. But we don't know that he didn't lie. We just assume. What if he did? Maybe Samuel Eliot Morison was right when he said that John Smith was a liar, if you will, but a thoroughly cheerful and generally harmless liar. If Smith was lying, he was lying with a purpose. Maybe he crafted a story of cross-cultural understanding to solidify his sales pitch. By that phase of his career, John Smith was fully committed to running PR for overseas colonization. He was trying to market an idea to the masses, trying to sell a hemisphere that terrified his buyers. In that, he wasn't unlike Mad Men, Don Draper, and Roger Sterling, who would spend their whiskey-soaked afternoons crafting marketing pitches for both Lucky Strike cigarettes and, you know, for the country of Israel. That's what I picture when I imagine John Smith now. I think of Roger Sterling dictating his exploits for his tell-all memoir, Sterling's Gold.
"So this is tape number 4 of Sterling's Gold by Roger Sterling."
Drunk on the past and something else. Conscious of making himself look like the best possible version of himself.
"It turned out it was something to do with my joie de vie, my romantic prowess."
Exaggerating how intimidating his youthfulness must have been because he's now intimidated by youth.
"But it was all about him hating my very youth."
And
Yeah, stumbling over details because it all happened so very long ago.
Anyway, sometime in the summer of 1939.
I imagine this natural human impulse exacerbated by the era John Smith lived in. This really was a new world. It was so new that you could just rename a massive region as large as England on a whim, and everyone would agree with this new reality. Yep, that's New England now. Cool. John Smith's America was a blank canvas onto which you could throw pretty much anything. It was open for uninhibited invention. Except, of course, it wasn't. Nothing John Smith did was truly harmless, even if he never meant any harm. Every act of cheerful creation, every new name on a map, was also an act of destruction. Epilogue. You think you own whatever land you land on.
The earth is just a dead thing you can claim.
When I look at the obelisk in Rye Harbor State Park, I see the beginning of New England, because that's what the plaques tell me to see. But I also see the end of what came before New England. And thanks to Disney, that erasure has a face. And no matter how much I look at the obelisk, it's not the bearded face on the golden map. It's blonde and clean-shaven, grinning, with the shaky singing voice of Mel Gibson. And a mind so malleable, meaning so empty of any internal drive, that it only takes a svelte figure and a stern lecture for him to suddenly get woke. The John Smith you and I think of now, thanks to the cultural power of Disney, isn't a person. He's a compromise. He is a bridge to all the other John Smiths we've met this episode, an attempt to reconcile all of their contradictions into a consumer-ready package. He may be a renowned savage killer, but once wind magic lets him hear the truth or whatever, yeah, he's a solid enough dude. As Grandmother Willow purrs,
he has a good soul, and he's handsome too.
Oh, I like her.
There are a few things worse than watching a movie that doesn't realize that one of its lead characters is a jerk. Disney's Pocahontas is exactly that sort of film. The entire experience hangs on your willingness to believe that Pocahontas' time is best spent teaching a man she just met about his deeply ingrained prejudice, rather than working with her tribe to find a way, maybe a peaceful way, to expel the gun-wielding, gold-mad barbarians that just landed downriver and will eventually decimate her civilization. Disney's Pocahontas is a film that tries to make the origin of America palatable for kids. Happy Meal ready, if you will. All the film did was underline how unpalatable all of this was. Not just the distortions, but once you cleared all those away, the underlying truth. Whatever the truth was. It didn't matter how much you cleaned John Smith up, shaved him, and turned him into a woke bae, rooting for him still felt gross. I think to some extent we're shooting the messenger here. In truth, John Smith may have been one of the good uns, relative to his contemporaries at least, and it was his flair for marketing that encouraged all the bad eggs to follow him. But sometimes you have to shoot the messenger to get your message across. History changes based on the values of the people recording it. Let's not pretend that it doesn't. We've seen ample evidence of that this episode. In 1867, historians refracted history to shine a light on the North over the South, on the Pilgrims and not on the John Smiths. In 2018, the light is directed to the Pocahontases, no, onto the Matawakas, and not to the John Smiths. I know it may have sounded like I've been standing John Smith this whole time, but I'm actually a bit relieved that he never reached true universal iconhood. I'm surprised he never did, and I do think that it's important that we understand all the weird twists and turns that undermine John Smith as an icon in America generally, and in New England particularly. But I ain't mad about it. Frankly, we don't need another white guy who, I hope I don't hit the microphone making these giant quote-unquote fingers, founded America to worship. In that spirit, let's leave John Smith where director Terrence Malick leaves him in his stunning, but somewhat flawed, examination of the Pocahontas myth, The New World.
Did you find your Indies, John?
This is the last we see of John Smith in the film. These are actually his last lines. From here,
For what little time is left, we follow Pocahontas and John Rolfe until she passes away.
We may have sailed past them.
Smith and Pocahontas both meet up in England, and Smith is reminiscing about their time together in Jamestown.
I thought it was a dream. What we knew in the forest. It's the only truth.
I think that this gets at what we should really get from the Pocahontas John Smith story. Something earth-shattering did happen in those forests in Virginia. Two cultures met, the world was changed in both positive and negative ways. But if the idea of America was born from that, it was just the tiniest, most fragile of seeds, and it could easily be blown on the wind somewhere else. Because this meeting takes place in England, just like the real one between John Smith and Pocahontas in 1617. And remember, both of them never make their way back to America again. The first few years of English settlement in America are marked by impermanence, a strange, fitful start, an unnatural cultural exchange. We'll pick right back up on that thread next episode, because we wouldn't know about our next icon if it weren't for John Smith. Yeah, there is one final way in which John Smith's expedition had unexpected consequences for the future of New England. He inadvertently made it possible for another icon to help the first settlers in Massachusetts. John Smith brought two ships on his 1614 whaling trip, and at the end of the summer, John Smith headed back, and he left the second ship behind in the care of his second-in-command, Thomas Hunt. Hunt was one of the bad eggs. Smith wanted him to trade with the natives and head on back. Hunt, under the pretense of trading, went to Cape Cod and the harbor that would become Plymouth, and he lured 24 Naussets and Pawtuxets aboard his ship. He didn't let them off. Smith was apparently furious when he found out that Hunt had defiled his New England paradise, but probably that was mostly because he sussed out what Hunt was really trying to do. Thomas Hunt had seen through Smith's ruse, and he knew that Smith was laying the groundwork for a New England settlement. Destabilizing native relations was a means of blocking him. It worked. Smith never made it back, and the next settlers to make it here stumbled upon the area by accident. Caught in the middle of this spat were 24 unfortunate humans stranded on the wrong side of the world. Next episode, we'll see how one of them, Squanto, found his way back to Plymouth and became an invaluable ally of the Pilgrims, who were living right where he had lived with his tribe only 6 years prior. A lot had changed in those 6 years. Now I'm going to open the lines to you, iconographers. You've heard my conflicted case for John Smith. Now you tell me. Isn't it iconic?
Don't you think?
I opened the episode saying I probably wasn't going to change your mind about John Smith or the dueling origin stories at the center of America. But if you did learn anything new, and you have had your perception slightly changed, reach out and tell me what that means to you, you know? I really do need you guys to tell me. I think I've been pointing out the empty space where it seems to me like an icon should be. And I'm sort of glad it's empty so that we can fill it with someone else, but maybe I'm sensing a void where there is none. Do you think that the guy who named New England would be more or less famous if he weren't a famous Southerner? Put another way, is the only reason there are even two monuments now in New Jersey because John Smith is famous for other stuff? Speaking of the good and the bad, am I underestimating the Disney film? You may be able to tell. It's not my favorite. Every time that I've watched it, I've thought less and less of it as a film. But maybe you can turn me around on it if you see something there that I don't. And I also want to hear about Terrence Malick's The New World. I really want to hear about that, if that's your thing. I am upset that I haven't really brought it up much until now, and I want to talk about it with people. Do you think that it navigates all the nuances successfully? Do you think it's a moving masterpiece or a three-hour slog? And let's talk about how good does Colin Farrell look as John Smith? I think pretty good. Office hours are open on Twitter at iconographypod, on the Facebook page, facebook.com/iconographypodcast, and on the website where you can find show notes and a transcript of the episode. That's at iconographypodcast.com. Also, if you want to leave ideas and questions in fawning iTunes reviews, I'll check those too, you guys. Iconography is written and produced by me, Charles Gustine. But this is the first episode where I wasn't going it alone. This episode would have been a lot more confusing if it weren't for the invaluable script review of journalist and producer Carol Zoll. You can check out her work at carolzoll.wordpress.com, and that's Zoll with two L's. And speaking of the team spirit, Iconography is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a Boston-centric collective of smart, idea-driven podcasts. And I can say that because I have been a non-stop, incessant, effusive fan of all of their shows since long before I joined the collective. You can check out all of them at hubspokeaudio.org. I think considering where we've ended up with John Smith, which is asking what he represents rather than what he was, it's fitting that I recommend an incredible new episode from a fellow Hub and Spoke show called Hi-Fi Nation, which takes compelling stories of ordinary and extraordinary human experiences and transforms them into an examination of philosophical ideas. In A Night of Philosophy, host Barry Lamb and producer Sandra Burton spend the night at New York's Central Library discussing philosophy with strangers, and a lot of those discussions are about white male privilege. Listening to the episode, I felt like I was there with Barry and Sarah at 3 in the morning, but I didn't actually have to be out and about in New York at 3 in the morning. Check that episode out at HiFiNation.org or anywhere fine podcasts are available.